Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Liping Chen, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we will be talking to Dr. Xinyi Zheng about her new book, Cultivating Membership in Taiwan and Beyond, Relational Citizenship. This book was published by Lexington in 2021. Citizenship is traditionally viewed as a legal status to be possessed. Cultivating Membership in Taiwan and Beyond proposes the concept of relational citizenship to articulate the value-laden, interactive nature of belongingness. Zheng examines the role of relationality, which produces and is a product of localized emotions. Zheng attends to particular histories and global trajectories embedded within uneven power relations. By focusing on Taiwan, a non-Western society with a tradition to adeptly attune to local experiences and those from various global influences, relational citizenship highlights the measures used to define and encourage interactions with newcomers. This book shows the multi-layer communicative processes in which relations are gradually created, challenged, merged, disrupted, repaired, and solidified. Zheng further argues that this concept is not bound to nation-state geographic boundaries as relationality bleeds through national borders. Relational citizenship has the potential to move beyond the East versus West epistemology to examine people's lived realities wherein the sense of belonging is discursively accomplished, viscerally experienced, and publicly performed. So this is a brief introduction about the book, and I look forward to talk about it more. So now, first of all, let's welcome our author, Zheng Xinyi. Xinyi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Liping, so much for the wonderful introduction and also for having me on your podcast. Really appreciate this program because it's one of my go-to places to learn about scholarship of Taiwan.
Well, thank you for your kind words and agreeing to be on the show. And all right, so can you tell us a little bit about yourself and also your research interest as well?
Taiwan is a place that nurtured me for about more than 20 years. And after graduating from college in Taiwan as a sociology major, I gained a teaching assistant scholarship to come to the U.S. for my master degree. And then later, I went into my PhD studies. And I studied in the field of intercultural communication, and my research interests have always crossed disciplinary boundaries, communication studies, intersectionality studies, citizenship and immigration studies. And I am particularly intrigued by various ways identity formations occur. So I examine this process from a critical perspective that often, include post-colonial and transnational lenses.
All right. Thank you for sharing that with us. And with that, so how do you move to this book project?
So this project really was a result of various forces combined. When I wrote my first book called Culturing Interface, Identity, Communication, and Chinese Transnationalism, this was years ago. I was a grad student with a H-F1 visa, living solely on a US $800 monthly stipend doing research as a pro grad student with a group of Taiwanese and Chinese immigrants living on the US-Mexico border and working there as well. And then in 2007, I became, you know, H-1B visa holder. And then in 2015, I gained my U.S. citizenship. And I started to really reflect more deeply on the meaning and feeling of being, you know, an F-1 visa holder, an H-1 visa holder, and then to, you know, a U.S. citizen passport holder. And it also happened during the time when there was a lot of, like a louder voices about the Dreamers and later, you know, the deferred action of childhood arrival, DACA, became more prominent conversation in the U.S. And whenever I visited Taiwan, I also noticed more newcomers and I read more news about newcomers in Taiwan. And because of my research interests, my curiosity started to grow. You know, I just decided to embark this journey as a dual citizen, right? Like I'm a Taiwanese citizen and also a U.S. citizen, and also working as a faculty in a U.S. institution. So in a way, this book was written as my personal and professional quest to just gain a deeper understanding and sorting out my feeling of a sense of being a citizen.
Thank you for sharing that with us. And especially you mentioned when individuals cross the borders, you know, either it's national borders or language border, cultural border, and always come with that border is the legal status, this kind of like designation of their identity or legal identity. And you mentioned that also different contexts in workplace and also in a personal life as well. So you mentioned citizenship, and this is also a keyword from your book title and also your book as well. So first of all, I would like to know what do you think about citizenship? And what is the differences or similarity between citizenship and membership, as both keywords are in your book title and also later in your analysis of different cases as well?
Yes. Thanks for noticing that. Those two keywords I was trying to highlight in the book title as well as the book itself. So citizenship is mostly or most commonly viewed as this, you know, sort of exclusionary transaction of rights and obligation between legal members and their state. So this is mostly a, you know, political scientist, for example, Charles Tilly's definition. So there is this sort of inclusion and exclusion process by nature. And I want to talk a little bit about perhaps a brief development of this concept in the field, right? So during the 1950s, sociologist Thomas Humphrey Marshall, based on the British experiences, expanded this notion of citizenship into like a civil citizenship where one could have representation in courts, and there's a political citizenship that led people to participate in politics, and also social citizenship that offer, you know, citizens these opportunities to and rights to be well, to prosper. So for example, receiving educational opportunities. And in the about mid-1990s, American anthropologist Ronaldo Rosado adds another dimension, which is a cultural citizenship. And that explains the rights for minorities to be culturally different. So you know, since then, there have been a lot more nuances added to the idea of citizenship based on identity, such as, you know, gender, sexuality, race, socioeconomic status. So this has been a very vibrant field. And so there is indeed similarity between citizenship and membership. So like we mentioned earlier, it is about a member's relation, legal relations to the state. And then both really are possible to be purchased, right? And then they allow the individual's access to resources. So if we're thinking about the just the idea of passports, you know, in 2014, the New York Times had an article reporting how wealthy people from places like China and Russia were buying citizenship of Malta. This is an island nation between Sicily and North Africa, and it's also an EU member. So citizenship and membership, acquiring of such allows a person resources and mobility to some extent. And so being a member of a group at the same time entails, you know, certain expectations, paying taxes, following rules and regulations to maintain the functioning of the entity. Right. So there's that similarity there. However, I see membership entails a notion of belonging that goes beyond the legal or political affiliation to a nation. So in a sense, one can be a citizen to a nation, yet not feeling belong at all times. So the sense of belonging is what I'm interested in exploring in the project.
Yeah, thank you for this amazing layout of both keywords in terms of the privilege or expectations that both keywords might include, but also this very interesting layer of belonging. As you mentioned, some people might get citizenship in one country, but that not necessarily feel belong or they feel as a member in that particular country. So with this two keywords tackled, another keyword is relational and relationality. So can you tell us about your use and approach of the word relationality? And also, what is the relational citizenship that you developed in this book?
Yes. So as I mentioned, you know, I grew up in Taiwan. And so, you know, being a Taiwanese, I'm heavily influenced by the idea of relationality in how a society functions. And citizenship as a study, as a field, even as a concept, is often connected to the Western nations with a strong legal connotation to it. And because of my background and, you know, the kind of environment that I grew up in, I started to rethink the idea and practice of citizenship from this sort of like a so-called non-Western perspective as a hope to decolonize our ways of thinking about citizen formations. So I came to learn about, there's this Italian sociologist, Dinardi. He proposed this idea of societal citizenship. And basically, it is a relational set of rights and duties of individuals and social groups. So in a way, he's saying that citizens are individual in relation. And to me, that idea was quite revolutionary because it moves citizenship beyond this individual realm, right? At the same time, it still remained viewing citizenship from the rights-based ideology that's informed by the Western liberalism. And I wanted to explore how this element could be built into a theory, sort of trying to see an idea in action. So the way I see citizenship is not rights to be owned, right? But it's rather a relationality accomplished by multiple parties through communication. And I call this process relational citizenship. And in a multicultural society, relational citizenship is a strategy that would allow, you know, interruptions, realignments, or sometimes an enhancement of national identity of loyalty. For example, you know, one of the elements in relational citizenship is how relational distance, I call it relational distance, between members could be constructed to create this sense of belonging or lack thereof. So the way the distance is managed is really rooted in the deeply held local values. And so, for example, in Taiwan, the idea of qing, which roughly can be translated into emotion or affection. So this idea of qing became a key element to generate how society feels towards certain members. And these local values can very quickly draw visceral and bodily kind of reactions to members and to our fellow, you know, citizens. So that's how I see relationality as a key ingredient, if you will, when we talk about and think about the concept and the process of citizen making.
Right, and then especially you mentioned this non-Western perspective in the citizen formation, individual, but also in terms of their belonging, relation, sometimes confrontation with the community. And I'm looking at the book cover since we're unpacking every keywords about your book title. And one thing I do like to mention is your book cover, the painting there. So Xinyi, would you like to tell us more about the painting, the book cover, and then how it is related to the concept of relational citizenship that you are developing?
Yes, of course. And I, you know, think my 15-year-old niece, Yu Yan, will be thrilled that Li Ping, you mentioned this painting as a book cover. So I thank you on her behalf here. So my niece did this painting called Gardening Taiwan's Memory. Taiwan is one of the indigenous group in Taiwan. And she, I believe, was about 12 or 13 when she created that painting. And it is a painting that shows hands holding on each other. So in a way that reminded me of the concept, or to me, it illustrates the concept of relational citizenship. It's about people intentionally holding on to each other to then, stay together and feel connected, right? When we're touching each other, there's a sense of feeling belong to a larger entity than ourselves. And the background of these hands in the painting were just mountains and, you know, green mountains, very lush. And that's, to me, what my hometown, Taiwan, refers to, as long as individuals are willing and consciously holding on to each other and feeling each other's presence. That is a group of citizens, working together and being, existing together in a space. So that's the reason that I chose her painting as a cover for this book.
Thank you, Xinyi, for introducing the work, but also the talented and also very inspiring young artist. For our listeners, you can see the book cover from our NBN book website, but also you can also Google this book. This is amazing artwork, and then can help us understand the relational citizenship. So we talk about the different theoretical framework and conceptual model about citizenship, membership, and relationality. So now we talk about Taiwan. And many of our listeners are interested in Taiwan, but may not necessarily familiar with the context for your analysis. So can you tell us a little bit about the context, either history, politics, or culture, that is central to your research context in this book?
Yes, I really appreciate the opportunity to offer some background of Taiwan, and I'm going to try to, be brief here. So in terms of location, as an island that's situated between the maritime routes of Europe, Asia, and Africa, Taiwan has experienced very vibrant trading activities as a strategic location as early as the 1500s. And because Taiwan was an unclaimed island sitting at the intersection of the Western and Eastern seas, it became a prize that the European power vied over. And they were Chinese traders and fishermen who were able to translate Aboriginal languages mixed with some Chinese words. So Taiwan was and has always been a cosmopolitan multicultural space. Historically, Taiwan has been partially and at times fully occupied by both Western and Eastern powers, from the Dutch, the Spanish, the Ming royal, Zheng, Chen Gong, and his offspring, the Japanese, to the KMT, Kuomintang, after World War II, Taiwan's people have been adapting to different regimes and therefore have been hybridizing their identity. And relating to its history is this sort of cultural aspect, right? So after the Dutch East Indian Company arrived, they further encouraged Chinese emigrating to Taiwan as a way to cultivate the land and also, bring them revenue because they taxed them, using them to help, to quell the Taiwanese Aborigines' resistance and rebellions against the company's exploitations. So Han settlers were encouraged to, settle the land, and this land were owned by the Aborigines, who were primary hunters. So there was tension, and the Han Chinese continue arriving to Taiwan for the next 400 years. And after the Dutch left, Guo Xingyan, Zheng Chenggong, a Ming's loyal, occupied Taiwan, and his family became highly influential with trading activities in South and East China Seas. So there was a lot of interactions and connections. So Taiwan is never like an island isolated, right? It's always this, mutual influences and a lot of exchange within its neighboring environment. And because the Zheng's family was so wealthy as a sort of formidable pirates, they accumulate a lot of wealth and they build strong navy, and then they encourage more immigrants to Taiwan. So both Dutch and Zheng's regimes, they made concerted efforts to influence Taiwanese culture. The Dutch missionaries, they came with the military, but then they also established schools to educate both local men and women. So these women were the earliest females who received education in Taiwan. The missionaries introduced Bible to the Aborigines and then create Xinganwen, which is a hybrid language between Dutch and the local words. And Zheng Chenggong came to Taiwan, started to kind of introduce Sino-centered education and promoted that. This is a kind of Chinese elite culture of Confucian values. And so you know, the Zheng's family built schools for children to learn the Chinese language, and particularly focusing on male cultural and political leadership. So even though Taiwan, remained, culturally and politically distinct from China, there was, influence of a Sinification. And after the Sino-Japan War, Taiwan was ceded to Japan in 1895 for half a century. And it was the literate elites, right, who continue to propel resistance and advocate for, self-governance of Taiwanese people during the Japanese colonization. So, there's a long tradition of making a living through hunting, fishing, and trading in Taiwan and Taiwanese people's experiences. Therefore, the transnational characteristics mixed with Eastern and Western cultural expressions continue to develop throughout Japanese colonization. And after World War II, the Allies decided to reinstitute Taiwan to Dr. Sun Yat-sen's Republic of China that was led by Chiang Kai-shek. And Chiang Kai-shek appointed the Fujian governor Chen Yi to basically as a minister of Taiwan. And the mainlanders saw themselves in the position of, I'm going to put in quotation, freeing Taiwan from the Japanese colonial imperialism. So they expected Taiwanese people to appreciate and give all their devotion to the KMT's efforts of in the war to fight with the communists. At the same time, the Formosans, although they resented the discriminatory treatment under the Japanese colonial government, after they encountered the mainland soldiers, many of these soldiers came from the Chinese rural village, the Formosans understood their more prosperous ways of living, their economy and higher education because, of Japanese colonial policy, partially because of that. And they expected to be treated as equal by the KMT. However, that wasn't the case. So that complicated relationships kind of, was one of the cause to the infamous 228 incident, where on February 27th, 1947, a widow named Lin Jiang Mai, who was selling black market cigarettes to make a living, was brutally hurt by agents from the Monopoly Bureau. And then so the next day, February 28th, couple of thousands demonstrators gathered together and then asked for, issue to be addressed. And a committee of prominent Taiwanese were organized to demand for appropriate settlement because, many people were killed and it didn't go far. And the KMT hardened its grip over Taiwan. So in the 70s, early 70s, ROC was expelled from the world organizations after many of the countries recognized the Chinese communist China officially. So Taiwan became, increasingly isolated. And then Taiwan has struggled for self, autonomy and self representation for many years. And it wasn't until the early 90s when Taiwan's then President Li Denghui started to promote a series of policy and visions to Taiwan to basically start to recognize Taiwanese people and its culture its own right, right? So Li Denghui was a native and Hokkien speaking Taiwanese who was elected directly by Taiwanese people as the first democratic Formosan president in 1996. And so Taiwan completed this transformation of democracy. So since then, Taiwanese people had directly elected three presidents, two of whom were native born from the DPP party, Democratic Progressive Party. So although Taiwan has become more open and democratic, the PRC, People of Republic China's pressure on Taiwan's self-identification never was absent. So it was under this historical context that the newcomers arrived Taiwan.
Right. And then thank you for laying out this historical chapters of serial colonizations by different powers and also political transitions from authoritarian regime and now democratic society as well. And you mentioned this kind of different and also multiple cultural influences and especially wave of immigrants. And this lead to our later we'll talk more about the newcomers as well. So with all this different transition, different changes in Taiwan's history, so what are Taiwan's experience in citizenship development?
As I mentioned, Taiwan has been Taiwan has been subjugated under many foreign powers, and in each of this period, there had been resistance against the, imposition of ruling from the outside of the island. And each of this resistance, in my view, created, regenerated, and added to this sense of subjectivity. So during the Dutch rule, there was a Chinese farmer, Guo Huayi, gathered an army of, many Chinese who live in Taiwan at the time to, fight against the Dutch, exploitation. And during the Japanese colonization, similar things happened. Taiwanese elite, advocated for creating a middle school in Taichung that was, at the same level as the middle school in Japan, right? So there were and had always been this kind of incidents where Taiwanese people recognized their own agency and their own identity that was distinctively Taiwanese. And that sense of consciousness continued to grow. And as I mentioned earlier, under Li Denghui's presidency, there, started to become even more pronounced and articulated, in the concept of Bentuhua, right, Taiwanization. And the process inherit this tradition of developing a sense of self without negating all the past influences, particularly in recent years. And this is the context that the newcomers come into in a society that had struggled with, understanding their traditions and potentials to continuously to become, quote unquote, Taiwanese, right? So it's a very sort of a open concept in the making at the present time. And up to 2018, more than 600,000 new arrivals moved to Taiwan because of marriage, and more than 75% were female. And the marriage immigrants and their offsprings are classified as the new immigrants and as the fifth largest ethnic group. And then at the same time, Taiwan had approximately 738,000 foreign residents, the majority coming as foreign laborers from Southeast Asia to work in the 3D industry, the dirty, dangerous, and difficult. And this was a result of policy that tried to respond to labor shortage. And there were also the so-called professional workers amongst these foreign residents. And these professional workers come from, you know, places like United States, Malaysia, India. So there was, as of 2018, there's a new economic immigration law that allows middle-level technical manpower to apply for permanent residency and settlement of their family. However, this law really was meant for middle and upper class newcomers, and because there's a requirement of a salary amount for monthly salary between like $1,000 to $1,300. So all this is to say that with the colonial past and then Taiwanese experiences developing a subjectivity under various, you know, foreign powers, to opening up to the global economy, absorbing the capitalistic ethos and neoliberal, you know, doctrine, we do see that ideology influencing Taiwan's present citizenship practices.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. And then I especially appreciate that in addition to earlier, you mentioned the different historical chapters about colonization, political transition, but you also mentioned here the economic development and also demographic composition of Taiwan, which is constantly evolving. And then the meaning of being Taiwanese or Taiwaneseness is in the process of becoming and then also in the process of making as well. So with that, you mentioned about the new immigrants in your response earlier. So I was wondering, can you talk more about how do these new immigrants, either they come to Taiwan by marriage or by work or for study, inform or complicate relational citizenship in Taiwan?
Yes, as you just, mentioned that this citizenship is an interactive, circular kind of practice. And, discourses about new immigrants and also use by new immigrants facilitates, you know, a sense of their belonging in Taiwan. And at the same time, newcomers, they experience belongingness differently. So in my work, I illustrate how relationality serves as a narrative strategy of citizenship making in Taiwan. And it is done through constructing this ideal citizens who relationally is located in family. So on the one hand, the public discourse use new immigrants to use the relationality of immigrants to, to kind of create this ideal citizens of Taiwan. And so, for example, when the term of new immigrants or new residents, 新住民, appeared in public discourses, it is oftentimes referred to women who come from Southeast Asian countries, and the term new residents and family are frequently combined. So that makes them inseparable from the domestic family sphere, right? So words to describe these newcomers usually are like mother of the Taiwanese son, wife of the husband, daughter-in-law of Taiwan, foreign spouse, Vietnamese mother, Indonesian bride. So their membership is really centered around their relationship to Taiwan and or to a quote-unquote real Taiwanese, right? So they are, or their relationality is established through their belongingness is established through, their relationality to Taiwan in public discourses. And that's sort of how they are implicated. At the same time, they also use certain, relational terms to describe themselves, right? So they themselves participate in the public discourses of constructing relational citizenship. So for example, many of the new immigrants I interviewed during my fieldwork, they use phrases like, sisters from Vietnam, 越南来的姐妹, sisters from Indonesia, 印尼来的姐妹, I want to go and be with my sister, 我跟姐妹在一起, or I come here to help my sisters, right? 来帮忙姐妹. So then themselves oftentimes, embedding themselves with this discourse of relational citizenship to identify themselves and connecting to members, other new immigrant members in Taiwan. I do want to point out that to many of these newcomers from Southeast Asia, this type of fictive kin networking practice is not new. Nevertheless, there is a very strong sense of, resorting to relationality as a way to establish their belonging in Taiwan.
Right. And then especially I appreciate what you mentioned that the belongingness can be a multiple dimension. So in the family or in the Taiwan public discourse, and also they build their own community as well. They are sisters or their people, and then they are kind of building and expanding their community. So with that, and we talk about the public discourse about new immigrants as well. So in your book, there's one chapter about space. And this is about two different spaces. It could be the physical space and it could be virtual online space. So I would like to hear more about how this physical or online spaces tell us about the mundane and performative nature of the relational citizenship.
Yes, I really appreciate you pointing out to this mundaneness of relational citizenship performances. So one of the unique situations in Taiwan citizenship is that the majority of the newcomers share similar physical characteristics with those who arrived earlier, right? So like one of my interviewees said, we're no different than what Taiwanese citizens may look like until we open our mouth and speak. So new immigrants in Taiwan can to some extent pass as Taiwanese. However, you know, being invisible risks of being forgotten, right? So to assert their presence in Taiwan, public spaces become arenas to witness their presence and also to struggle over their belongingness. So these places, whether it's physical space or online space, are what anthropologist Mary Pratt called contact zones, where cultural meets, clash, grapple with each other, oftentimes in context of unbalanced power relations. So one example of the physical place where I really saw this relational citizenship unfolding was during one of my research trips. I visited a new immigrant cultural hall in Taoyuan. And this is Taoyuan has the fourth largest immigrant population in Taiwan. And this building was interesting because it used to be Taoyuan Police Department. And in 2018, it was renovated to become a cultural hall for new immigrants. So, you know, symbolically and materially speaking, it holds a lot of significance. And during my field trip there, there was an interactive art show called Dear Future Me, and it was an exhibition of photographs that were taken by new immigrants after taking a series of workshops. And the workshops was held by, you know, the local government with the, you know, I believe a sociology professor from Taipei's help. So after, you know, attending a series of workshops, 8 female, they call them cultural ambassadors, they display photos that they took. And these photos represented who, you know, she is and who she has become since she left her home country. And there were 8 stations there. Each station has a portfolio in 5 languages: English, Indonesian, Mandarin, Thai, and Vietnamese. And in the portfolio, basically, there's description where participants explain her journey of relocating to Taiwan, and they talk about these everyday activities they engage in, like working in the factory, caring for family, working farmland, starting a new business. And they talk about these everyday activities as a way to demonstrate their citizenship by relating to the audience. Because as the audience, you know, we see these everyday activities, everyday living, like what, you know, many of us do. And we start to imagine a stronger connection. And so to me, in this public and also intimate space, the ways these members relate to each other and to Taiwan were witnessed, while their differences were actually manifested in various languages, cultural practices, nationalities, and occupation. So this community hall conjures a sense of imagination about the future. And then I call this act as collective dreaming. So they're talking about the past, the present, but inviting us as audience to imagine what the future could be. So in addition to physical space, the online spaces also are arenas to witness various relationality in action. Taiwan Public Television produced several award-winning shows that has online platforms, and these shows are about newcomers in Taiwan. And one of the shows called Oh My Taiwan Style, that's to basically show international students' perspectives and experiences of Taiwan. And one episode featured Cho Huan, a Vietnamese graduate student in education who teaches Taiwanese people Vietnamese language and culture. And Cho Huan's mother was also a newcomer in Taiwan. So the audience learned that Cho Huan, from watching the episode, the audience learned that Cho Huan and her Taiwanese boyfriend, collaborated with her to create online video clips of Vietnamese language lessons. So by watching these videos, we as audience witness this inter-ethnic couples showing, ways to expand Taiwanese viewers' image of the Vietnamese newcomers, because there were stereotypes of Vietnamese newcomers as cheap laborers or foreign brides. And from that stereotypes to now, because we're watching, both collaborating as equal partners, there is a sense of seeing and witnessing a equal partnership who's Cho Huan as an equal partners to her boyfriend. Her Vietnamese culture and language are just as interesting and attractive, to the audience. And then that episode also drew, many comments and responses online. So this online space as a place for us to see, interactions where relationality is in the process of being built. And of course, there were rare comments where discriminatory and even racist comment was made about, newcomers from Southeast Asia. But at the same time, there were always immediate, engagement to dispute, this imperialistic way of, treating and viewing other fellow human beings. So I see both physical and online spaces as places where relationality is being molded and, reinvented and sometimes challenged, right? To make us all think about what it means to be a Taiwanese and to belong to Taiwan.
Right. And it's especially you mentioned this, what you term this kind of like collective dreamings, the dimension and also different practices of this collective dreaming and also this vision for the future, which is multilingual, multicultural, and also have multiple possibilities and multiple trajectories as well. So now we talk about Taiwan, the histories and different communities, new immigrants. And the next question is about Taiwan and beyond. So the question will be about how does Taiwan use this relational citizenship to navigate its complicated position, especially in the geopolitical sense in the global community?
Yes. So I wanted to also kind of add a little bit more onto these sort of performances of relational citizenship that is oftentimes to be struggled over. So there, has been, conflicts and fights for newcomers' presence in Taiwan as, full members that belong, right? So I want to make sure that I also stress on that this is not all the kind of, happy kambawa, kind of process. In the process, there definitely were, struggles. And So in answering your question about how Taiwan is using relational citizenship to connect to or exist in a larger global environment. So because of Taiwan's unique and complex positioning in the world constrained by the PRC, its citizens become, you know, an important avenue to build its standing in the world, right? So in turn, this need also allows its newcomers to gain their footings in Taiwan. So the concept of relational citizenship interacts with, you know, these constraints and solidifies Taiwanese national identity. And that can be, you know, that was witnessed in several areas. So first of all, newcomers' relationality is viewed as Taiwan's conduit to the world. Both former President Ma Ying-jeou and current President Tsai Ing-wen have encouraged new immigrants and their offsprings to maintain their mother tongues and cultures. So, for example, in 2013, former President Ma said that, I'm quoting here, Taiwan needs to cultivate relevant talents and emphasize relationships with the region of Southeast Asia. And in Tsai Ing-wen, President Tsai's first inauguration speech, she also announced this new southbound policy to broaden exchanges and expand Taiwan's ties with countries in Southeast Asia and India. And then in a serious policy, there were programming and resources being, you know, dedicated to focus on the second generations living and learning abroad, spending summer visiting their parents' country of origin. And this cultural exchange served as slow media that brought about influences. So in, you know, both of the national leaders' visions and policies, we see second generation of immigrants' connections too, and also their language ability of another country are viewed as, you know, a symbolic capital for themselves as well as for Taiwan. And sorry. So the focus on the newcomers' relationality was effective because the language that was used to describe them, that's very heavily focusing on relationalities of them to Taiwan, using the concept of Qing that draw the Taiwanese native, so-called natives, to recognize and accept the newcomers' belongingness to Taiwan in the process. And at the same time, relational citizenship also helps create both internal and external borders. Many programs that offer resources to newcomers often use household as a unit for qualification. For example, in a 2018 program, newcomers could borrow tablets for free up to 30 days. However, most migrant workers do not have family in Taiwan, so then they indirectly were excluded from, you know, the resources. And these migrants also serve as the backdrop against Taiwanese government's highlighting itself as, you know, one of the nation's most effective at securing its border. And in 2018, a U.S. report on trafficking in persons report, Taiwan was labeled and recognized as a first-tier status for the 9th executive year. And it was specified that unlike China, who was, you know, a tier 3, Taiwan was tier 1. And the then U.S. Secretary Mike Pompeo and Ivanka Trump made a special mentioning of Taiwan's achievement. So, you know, Southeast Asian transmigrants were highlighted in Taiwan's efforts of fighting against human trafficking. And while human trafficking remains very significant, you know, human rights issues to confront, U.S. annually rank nations into various tiers and then therefore use foreign aid as a strategy to sanction, you know, countries classified as, say, you know, tier three, right? So regulating transnational migrants in Taiwan is intricately connected with Taiwan's prominent role when addressing global issues of human trafficking. So in a way that newcomers' relational relationality is also used as a way to fortify, you know, Taiwanese border. So certain newcomers are integrated into Taiwan's citizenry while others are not, but both in some way extend or help to extend Taiwan's international space and relationality with the West.
Right. And then so we talk about Taiwan, we talk about border crossing, we talk about new immigrants. But in your book, very interestingly, you also talk about the United States. And then you develop this term relational amnesia as well. So I was wondering, can you tell us a little bit more about what is the relational amnesia in crafting citizenship in the United States?
Yes. So even though the concept of relationality was derived from Taiwan's experience, and I really wanted to show its applications to other societies. And so in my book, I applied this concept to examining the U.S. Situation. And I examining the discourses about immigrants in the U.S., during like two periods of times. One is in the 2017 and 2018 when the term chain migration was popularized by former President Donald Trump. And the other time was during the Great Depression between 1938 to 1939. And these two periods were interesting to me and comparable is because these are the two periods that anti-immigration sentiment was very high. So I examining public discourses in these two periods during the Trump administration, I look at, you know, his tweets and reaction to the tweets, as well as mainstream media's reporting on, you know, chain migration. And during the Great Depression time, I look at a nationally popular broadcasting series called Americans All, Immigrants All. This was a radio program that featured 26 episodes of immigrant stories from various countries. And it was a collaboration between the governments, academic, and also civic communities. And so in analyzing this two period, even though relationalities of newcomers were described and framed slightly differently, I found that newcomers are encouraged to dissociate themselves from their past. And so there was, seems to be, you know, even like an expectation for them to sever connections to their former lives. And so their relationships between, you know, their current and future life in the U.S. and their past, their relationship to their past in their country of origin was organized in almost like an oppositional kind of binary way. And so I use the term relational amnesia to really refer to this lost connection with previous generations. And this loss of connections results in a truncated memory of one's cultural history. And I believe that one of the risks is this generational loss of, you know, collective memory and cultural history that really expands beyond physical bounds like nation states. So relational citizenship, therefore, to me, offers a possibility to resist against this impact of relational amnesia, because this relational amnesia at the same time is supported by the idea of singular loyalty. I think by focusing on relationalities of newcomers, and in fact, all citizens, right, provides an alternative to reimagining how to do belonging in our current world, where there's abundant of voluntary and involuntary movements.
Right. And then especially you mentioned this possibility of the alternative model, alternative formation of belonging that is across border, national border, and linguistic cultural border. So this is about the book. And before we wrap up, we would like to know what you are working on right now, or maybe you would like to share with us what your next project will be.
Certainly. So I continue to be interested in Taiwan's subjectivity development, and I've co-edited a book on resistance in Taiwan and Hong Kong, which will be released next year by Michigan State University Press. And in the collection, I also wrote a chapter analyzing how President Tsai Ing-wen incorporated relationality in her rhetoric on building Taiwan-style nationalism. And on the other hand, I continue to apply relational citizenship to examining the U.S. context. So I analyzed and try to understand Asian Americans' relationality in the aftermath of the verdict on the SFFA versus Harvard's case. So the article will be published soon in the Western Journal of Communication. Currently, I'm conducting interviews with Asian American women to understand their experiences.
All right. So, Xinyi, that all sounds fantastic project, and especially looking forward to your upcoming publication and also chapters as well. I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed this book and the conversation.
Well, thank you so much for having me on and for hosting this program.
I also want to thank you, our audience, for being with us till the end. Take good care. Stay safe. We will see you next time. Goodbye.
Bye.